everyone. This is the third interview around imposter syndrome. This is Sarah Pittaway from the University of Worcester. And the reason I asked her to come and speak to me today is because she presented at UKSG in 2018 on her feelings around imposter syndrome. So welcome, Sarah.
Thanks, Ruth.
The first question I wanted to ask you was really to describe your role. It's a very long title. I can't remember it. So perhaps we could start there.
Yeah, sure. So I'm head of library academic engagement at The Hive in Worcester. Probably just to set the scene, The Hive is Europe's first public and university integrated library. So we're really, really unique. It's a really exciting and innovative place to work. And then my role, as I said, is leading the library academic engagement team. So my team kind of look after the relationships with our academic colleagues and with students. So they teach our students, you know, all these really important library research skills they need. They work with academics on things like embedding reading into their curriculum. And we do loads of projects and research, and we do a lot of work around working with students as partners as well. So developing, designing, evaluating our services to make sure that they do what the students actually need rather than what we think they need, which is a trap we can all fall into. And then my role is really the kind of the strategy and the leadership around all of that, as well as plugging us into stuff that's going on at a more institutional level and stuff that's going on across the department.
So what would you say your main priority is at the moment in your role? I assume with coronavirus, it's been a bit strange.
It's been an interesting year. Yep. Main priority at the moment, I think, is just making sure everyone gets through to the end of the year, that the students carry on being supported. The team have been fantastic during this whole year. You know, we've had to flip everything online. And, you know, we had some, 12 months ago, we had some very, very stressed students who were suddenly at home on their own.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So the team have just been amazing in supporting students and making sure that they get everything that they need to be able to carry on in their studies and not struggle too much.
So when did you start this current role? Is it the same one as you had in 2018 or a different role?
Kind of both.
Okay, as usual.
So I've had a change of job title and job description since 2018. I think I was a team leader for academic services.
Yes, I remember.
But it's not exactly a different role. The role has changed sort of naturally throughout the time I've been doing it, and it's increased in strategic remit and the leadership remit. So I think around 2018, the job was regraded, given a new title, a new job description, but it was to better reflect what I was already doing. So in 2018, I was in that transitional period.
Makes sense. And when you spoke at UKSG, what prompted you to kind of propose that as a subject for the conference?
So I think the year before I'd done the Aurora programme, which is Advanced HE's leadership programme for women in higher education. And we talked on that programme about imposter syndrome. And I think one of the speakers we had, who was a pro vice chancellor, a deputy vice chancellor, talked about it. And she said that one of the things she'd found really valuable is when other people say, do you know what, I have this experience, and it makes you feel it's not just you.
Yes.
So I thought, right, I'm going to do that, because I know what I've kind of got a sense of what people's public perception of me is. And I thought, you know what, that doesn't reflect how I necessarily feel. So it's probably going to be quite powerful if I stand up and say, hi, my name's Sarah and I'm an imposter, which is how I opened those.
So I remember.
Terrifying.
So I was in the audience admiring you for actually speaking out about how you felt, but also with the recent interviews I've done on imposter syndrome, often the sense of being an imposter actually makes you perform better. And I wonder whether you feel that sense of, you know, not quite being up to wherever you should be, kind of motivates you to, you know, work harder in a way, I suppose. Or is it something, another kind of effect on you?
Do you know, I don't think I've thought of it like that, but yes, I suspect you're right. I suspect there is that element, because I don't know, taking an example of going into, I don't know, a really important meeting where, you know, all the sort of top brass are going to be there. If you're feeling like an imposter going into that, you're probably going to prepare that much more to make sure that you feel ready to be in that setting and to hold your own with those people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the probably the element.
So one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is also because you're female and the other two interviews I've interviewed are male, both different ages. So one who's retired and the other one who's 29. And one of the statistics I came across was that when men and women were surveyed, then it was almost the same percentage were declaring they felt an imposter. 52, I think, for women and 49% for men. But when women were interviewed independently as a solely female survey, 70-odd% declared they felt an imposter. And I wonder if you mentioned the lady you spoke to originally and who prompted this, whether you think it's something that affects women more than men, or do you feel it's a completely non-gender specific issue?
I think it's hard to say. So when I was sort of preparing for that UKSG talk, I definitely read articles that people say, yeah, this is a much more gendered experience, and yes, women are more likely to experience it. But actually, when I did those sessions at UKSG, I had a mixed audience. Yes. There were men and women in the audience, and you know, everyone kind of said, yeah, I experienced this. This is normal for me. Yeah. I think we do have to recognise that there's, you know, there are other factors at play in it. So I'm thinking of things like, you know, if you don't see people like you, she says, inverted, in the roles that you're aiming for, I think it's probably much easier to feel like an imposter, because you can't see that pathway. So I'm thinking, you know, I work in libraries, we're very female dominated as a profession.
Right.
Once you start looking at the senior roles, that split changes. There's a lot more in the senior roles. And we're incredibly white, you know, there's like there's something like 96.7% of library workers.
Wow,
It's
the same quotient, isn't, you know.
Yeah, it's something we desperately need to work on. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff around imposter syndrome, I think, that intersects with those other issues that are going on in society, so with race, with gender, etc.
But do you think age plays a factor? Because the reason I say this is that I got a job when I was 25, where I was managing 50 people, and I so felt an imposter in that role, and partly because a lot of the people were older than me. And one of my coping strategies, and this sounds really odd, but I wonder if other women have it as well, is to wear high heels and a suit every day. And somehow the heels gave me some kind of edge. I'm quite short, so
I just made me
feel a little bit more important, if that makes sense, inside. And I wondered how you coped, you know, practically, when you first started in your role and felt those feelings.
Yep, that's another good question. So when I started in my current role, it was my first proper, again, inverted commas, sort of managerial role. And I was 32.
Okay.
And everyone I was managing was either, there were a couple of people that were about my age.
Yes.
Everyone else was older, you know, some of them significantly so.
Right.
And definitely that contributed to that feeling of, you know, they're gonna be looking at me, right? They're gonna be looking at me going, who are you? You're
barely out. Snapper.
Yeah. How dare you be telling us what to do? So, I mean, one of the things I definitely did is no one knew my age for years and years. I wouldn't tell anyone. I mean, now that I'm 40, I'm quite happy to tell.
Yes, fair enough.
Back then, I wouldn't tell anyone. I think probably there is a certain amount of power dressing that goes on.
Yeah.
I'm seeing a bit less so now, but yeah. I think they're just these little, and actually one of the things I had to do is what a friend of mine used to call is having a word with yourself.
Yes, self-talk.
Yeah, the first day I went into that job, I was like, right, what they're expecting to see is a manager. So they're going to see a manager.
Excellent.
They don't know that I'm screaming inside. It's fine.
Yes, so
you're going to see a manager.
Well, no, and I think that kind of, was it fake it until you make it thing, particularly when you enter into a new job. So what I wanted to talk to you about now was kind of what the transition has been like for you 3 years down the line, because what I felt was when I started that job, I was out of my depth. I thought everyone was looking at me. I thought everyone just could see through me somehow and knew that I didn't feel confident in that role. And I just kind of hoped for the best and was as nice as possible to everyone that I could come across. But then 3 years down the line, I actually reached a point where, you know, they've got to know you, you've got to know them. I wasn't as intimidated with the age thing because some of my team were in their 50s and some of them had some difficult times. And so you kind of see people in every walk of life, in every kind of stage of life, and realize that actually everybody has vulnerabilities. And so my feelings of vulnerability when I entered, you know, that job were very different 3 years down the line. And when I left, I really felt I'd kind of grown into it somehow.
Yeah.
And that you're kind of growing beyond it almost. And then you go into your next role and then maybe feel a little bit of an imposter then. So I wonder if there's like a transition or a journey, you know, classic Strictly kind of terminology. Have you been through a journey since 2018, which has taken you to a more confident place?
Yeah. I mean, I think probably in 2018, to be fair, I'd already been through quite a bit of that journey.
Okay.
I think you have to be able to stand up in a room and go, hi, I'm an imposter. You know,
yeah.
3 years before that, no way would I have admitted to that. So you've got to be in a certain good place to even say that. But then, yeah, another sort of 3 years down the line, probably feel a lot more sort of, I don't know if secure is the right word, but, you know, you've got that experience behind you. You can look back and go, yeah, okay, those are my successes. Those are the things that I've done that were actually really hard. And, you know, I've done all right at them. I can point to things that are, you know, to counteract that little negative voice that's going, come on, who are you? What are you doing? But then, of course, then you're thinking about, well, as you've said, what's the next move?
Yes.
That's going to be a step up. And then the imposter strikes again, like, wow. Are you sure you can do that? You can do what you're doing now, but can you do the next thing?
Really? Yeah. And I think a lot of it's about envisioning yourself in a certain role. So I know this isn't quite directly relevant, but working in the homeless sector, and I'm doing a bunch of mentoring with young people at the moment, girls at my daughter's school. What I've seen is that sometimes your vision for what's possible for yourself, or in the mentoring situation, what's possible for those pupils, when they start the conversation with me, it's kind of, you know, their hopes and dreams are relatively pedestrian, if you like.
Mm.
And then as you continue talking, the kind of aspiration and the, oh, maybe I could do that kind of moment hits. And I think the same thing in the homeless sector, so this is a really strange comparison to make, but what I found in talking to a friend of mine who was homeless for a year, he could not envision being successfully rehomed and having a successful life. And that transition from no hope to actually maybe this is possible for me has been a real visible shift in his mind. And I think the same with any youth development program. My cousin runs a youth development charity where they do outdoor adventure kind of stuff. And I think the same journey happens there. It's like this suddenly ping moment where you go, oh, I can build a whatever. I wonder if it's almost human nature, imposter syndrome, that without that picture of yourself being confident, able, skilled, you know, filling the role with all its possibility just takes time in a way.
You need to build that picture up, I think.
Yeah And it takes a while.
It does.
Maybe we're just not kind enough to ourselves. And that's the other thing that I'm wondering about imposter syndrome, because talking to Roger Horton, he said that he felt an imposter, but actually he stayed in the role for 20 years. And was very successful, and so was the CEO who stepped down. You know, he's made millions. And the funny thing is that I think, so my imposter sense now is being a parent. I always feel like I'm winging it. I never feel I'm quite grown up enough to have a child. You know, I kind of felt that since she was born, really. I think it's one of those weird things that you sort of like, you mean I'm responsible for this? and I think maybe it's because the rules, guidelines, objectives and all that aren't very clear. And maybe at least as a job, you kind of have a pathway for what you're supposed to do. So this isn't, you know, work-related imposter syndrome, but increasingly that I talk to people, what I realise is everyone feels an imposter in some way, in some area of their life. But actually, the imposter, sense of being an imposter in one area of your life does not reflect what you feel like in the rest of your life, necessarily.
Yeah, definitely.
A comment rather than a question.
We're all winging it all the time.
We are. Life has no rules, and that's the thing that when you're a kid, so this is the other thing I've noticed, particularly with the younger girls, you know, 14, 15. When I was at school, I thought there was a path that you were supposed to take. And that there were very fixed kind of directions or choices that you kind of, you just got to, you like got to 22 and you did this, and you got to 27 and you got married, and you got to 32 and you get a baby, and you, or whatever those things are, or career wise. So then you kind of enter your adult life and realize that nobody's telling you what to do. And I wonder whether that kind of, it's quite a difficult transition when you're young. So early career can really impact you, I would think.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you believe in that kind of theory of life or whether you have a different approach.
No, I think you're right. Because I also mentor sort of that age group for the Girls Network. And yeah, it is really interesting to see their fixed perceptions, I guess, of, you know, what it's all going to look like and what they do next. And
how do you think we could change it for that generation so that they don't feel an imposter constantly in their early 20s and 30s?
Yeah, and just give them sort of some self-belief, because again, if it, you know, if it is particularly gendered, there's, you know, the opportunity to kind of go, no, you can do things. I might get on my feminist soapbox all the time with my mentee. She's quite used to it.
Okay,
cool. And another thing, emotional labour.
it's strange because was it one of the other articles I read a few years ago was about board representation of women, board women, but people on the board. And that one of the men in this particular interview said, well, women just don't fit into the boardroom culture. I blogged about it in about, I think it's probably early 2018, because that infuriated me, absolutely hit every button that you can possibly imagine in terms of fury, because ultimately if the boardroom isn't designed for women, and you want to have a gender inclusive board, then you redesign the boardroom.
Yeah.
So thinking along those lines, and thinking about what you just said before we started the interview, actually, about the gender proportions within your university, you know, that in the middle management tiers, it's mostly women. And then as you go further up the senior ranks, that perhaps it becomes more male dominated. How do you think your culture could maybe change to accommodate maybe different needs or different types of people, different personalities, different styles in your organisation?
So I should say at Worcester, actually, we do really, really well for gender parity. We've got, I think it's either the smallest or the, I think it's the smallest gender pay gap in the country.
Okay, cool.
The university. So overall, we do really well. And actually, the library team is primarily women, including our director.
Right.
When you look in the library sector, which I was saying earlier, is that we're predominantly female. But then as you get to those higher levels, that's when you sort of start to see the gender balance shifting a bit. And it is something that as a sector we're trying to look at. So one of the things that I've advocated for Worcester is in our job descriptions, unless there's a really good reason not to do on the job description, it should say this job, even if it's full-time, is open to part-time job share, flexible working arrangements. Because one of the things that stops women progressing, of course, is quite often they're the ones who've taken on the childcare responsibilities, they've maybe taken a career break, they need to work part-time hours. So actually, we're putting a barrier in place if we say, well, actually, we can only have full-time staff.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes, I don't know if it's like a customer services role as shifts.
Yes.
Patterns. You can't do that. But for all of the others, think, you know, even senior roles, we should be looking at that sort of practice.
Well, and also, so one of the things I was thinking was job shares. So I am a single parent, so part-time hours and not working full-time is a godsend for me.
Yeah.
But also, even if I have worked full-time for about 10 years as a single parent, even the flexibility and, you know, sort of understanding of my boss, that's been really important. If my daughter's ill and I have to work from home, if I have to leave to collect her from nursery for whatever reason at that time, or there's a problem at school or even a concert at school or something, then that flexibility to kind of work is really important so that I can fulfill as many mummy things as I possibly can, basically. But I chose, since I was sectioned, not to work full time and to only work part time and to work for myself. And the reason for that is that I suddenly realised that when a child is quite young, most of the support, maintenance, childcare, motherhood stuff is quite practical. So you make sure they've got a packed lunch, you check their school uniforms ironed, all those kind of things. Now she's 12. My responsibilities and the way I support her has shifted dramatically. And so although obviously I still make her pack lunch and all those kind of practical things, actually she pretty much gets up on her own, dresses on her own, gets her school stuff ready. All that sort of stuff is taken away from me.
Mm.
What I'm left with is the emotional support things.
Mm.
And the emotional support things actually are harder if you work full time. So before I would have got up at seven, got to school, made sure her lunch was in a bag, made sure her school books were in a bag, picked her up after the childminder just looked after her, get home, make tea, flop, go to sleep. That's pretty much my routine. Yeah. But it was kind of sustainable because it was pretty predictable.
Yeah.
Whereas now, I come home from work, well, like, she comes home from school, I'm already at home because I work from home, and the intellectual challenge of supporting her, the emotional availability I have to offer is completely different. And so what I've actually found is that the teenage years are likely to be harder in terms of concentration, if you like, than with a younger child. And so when I was thinking about the kind of board stuff, one of the reasons I think a lot of women don't apply for the senior positions is because of that headspace. So I wonder if, you know, if you have a child when you're in your 30s and you're likely to get senior management in your 40s, and then actually your childcare responsibilities and your parenting responsibilities become more arduous in a different way, that unless you work for an organisation that, I don't know, has the flexibility to allow you to adapt your hours, work from home, not commute.
Yeah.
And though all those things have kind of changed under coronavirus. So one of my friends has a child about the same age as my daughter. She was commuting nearly 2 hours each way every day. She had two sons. And ironically was working with Asia in the morning and the US in the afternoon.
Oh!
And actually didn't really participate in any team function within her own office. And until coronavirus, she was told that it wasn't possible for her to work from home. She had to come in. And obviously coronavirus has shifted that entirely, because she worked from home for over a year, very happily, thank you very much. And so I think maybe it's not just the part-time hours, it's also about the kind of conditions of working, what your responsibilities are. And the other thing I've been wondering is, you know, if you want to be a more senior person, but actually to do that senior role, either they don't need that person 24/7, you know, 5 days a week, or it's a kind of tryout role, you know, so it's a kind of new, there's a lot of diversity inclusion roles being adopted in publishing and stuff like that. So, or a history, that role, it's a new role completely. What I've been wondering is whether you could like work 4 days a week, work 2 days a week in your old job, and 2 days a week in your new job.
Oh, that's interesting. Actually,
that transition point would be really cool, because it's kind of, you're almost job sharing with yourself. And it also allows the company that you're working for to kind of test the water on what that job's going to look like, what your responsibilities like to be, and kind of build a path for that. So those are the So what I was thinking about as a, you know, female girl in my 40s, is that intellectually I'd really like to do something more senior.
Mm.
But if that means I have to fly around the globe constantly, or, you know, be in the office in London all the time, that just isn't practical for me.
Yeah.
So that's what I was wondering about in terms of working conditions where, and this would also help with imposter syndrome, I think, because if you got to kind of stay in your foundation role that you're really familiar with and confident in, but then extend yourself either through shadowing and then moving into a role, or doing a role one day a week where you're mentored through that day, do you know?
Yeah.
Help people adapt to new situations much more easily. It's kind of a buddy system.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's loads of stuff like that. And I think the last year has really shown up some of this stuff. You know, because I've got quite a few people in my team, direct reports, who, you know, they've been balancing care and responsibilities, childcare, over the last year. It's been hard for them.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're willing to be flexible, you know, I mean, basically what I said at the beginning was, look, do what you can when you can.
Yes.
You know, don't worry. I know you've got family responsibilities, and, you know, they fitted stuff in. And if, okay, yeah, maybe it wasn't necessarily great for them to be doing emails at 11 at night, but if actually they could do that and, you know that they'd got the homework done in the day, and they were able to pick up the bits of the job later on or around kids.
Yes.
You know, it got them through that period.
Yeah.
They survived it. It was tough.
Well, no, exactly. You kind of have to be very adaptable and very flexible about your working arrangement and just get it done, but get it done maybe in a completely different way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the other thing which I've been writing about recently is, women tend to lead in a different way to men as a general rule.
Mm.
And the cliche has been that to get promoted, you have to act like a man.
Mm.
You know, be driven, motivated, ambitious, sort of delivering objectives very clinically, if you like, and achieving goals and targets, particularly in something like sales. But once you're in that senior leadership position, you actually need the female characteristics of compassion, empathy, looking at resourcing, support, understanding people's personality and needs, from a manager, a leader, inspiration, empowerment, delegation, all those things.
Yeah.
So one of the things I was thinking about was actually organizations are appointing people who show certain characteristics to senior leadership and then expecting them to completely switch their style.
Mm.
And actually, maybe we should think more about rewarding the senior leadership qualities you see in the sort of middle management tiers and somehow recognizing and appointing those people into senior leadership positions, because actually most people are technically competent at something or you know, very good at sales or whatever. When they become a leader, they have to shift their whole ethos, their whole motivation sort of landscape, if you like.
Mm.
Because if you're like technically competent and really passionate about building a piece of technology, and then you're appointed to be a leader, and actually then you're leading people who are building that technology, but you're not involved anymore.
Mm,
and the very thing that truly motivated you to be in that role has kind of disappeared for you.
Yeah.
So what I was wondering was whether, you know, you could have kind of a leadership track of people who show the qualities of senior leadership, but obviously can't just be appointed straight up. And there should also be a career pathway, which isn't just you're technically great in your team, therefore you can lead that team. Because actually being technically great doesn't mean you're a natural leader at all.
Mm.
So I wondered if maybe that you, I don't know how you feel about this, but if you have ambitions to be a senior leader, how would you want that kind of transition to take place? And how would you want to be nurtured into those kind of roles?
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, I guess me being me, I've kind of looked for the opportunities myself.
Yes.
You know, so I don't know whether it's like joining external groups or external training. But then I'm also mindful of, so one of the conversations we're having at the moment is, a lot of people in the roles that I manage don't have direct management experience or supervisory experience.
Yes.
So they then find it harder to see themselves up in the next position. Yes, so we're kind of trying to look at, well, what can we do to help those people kind of think about, you know, think about the stuff like distributed leadership. So actually, even if you're in a management role, what are you doing that's still leading
people? Yes.
Because you will be doing something, whether it's a project or managing a classroom or whatever it may be.
So we're trying to look. Is there's a lot of digital transformation going on. Two or three years ago, I noticed that universities are often recruiting roles that we've traditionally seen as publishing roles, if you like. Digital transformation, going into open access, managing platforms, looking at how the user experience is for your students and making sure all your platforms are integrated. So it feels like, in a way, the universities have to innovate faster and harder.
Definitely.
Than the publishers, simply because of the expectations of your students, and you'll lose the, what's it called, the engagement of those students, but also perhaps the, you just might attract them, they're your customers. So if you haven't got that kind of program in place, then it's very difficult for you. And I wondered how your university maybe is looking to adapt to kind of accommodate that student experience, and what kind of roles you might think will come up that don't currently exist. This is a really hard question because it's completely off the cuff. So in publishing, a lot of focus has been on the user experience.
Yeah.
So, you know, Airbnb trumped the hotel market and the B&B market because their user experience is so slick. And what I've seen talking to Steve from Hodder Education, my next podcast for anyone who's listening, is that really integration, single sign-on, knowing what's available, being able to access resources easily, trusting the security of the platform, trusting that the permissions you've given to your teachers and students protect the privacy of everyone on that platform, and the statistics, data and analysis around it. It feels like that universities are kind of in a similar period of transition, and we'll have to respond to the expectations of those coming through primary and secondary in the next decade. So I often talk about my daughter. I apologize to people who are sick of hearing me talk about her. She's a YouTuber, a TikToker, a Snapchatter. She uses all the social media platforms. She loves them. When she gets to university, I don't see that she would tolerate a non-integrated experience. I think she will want video, audio, learning that is interactive, exciting, interesting. She'll want the ability to kind of be able to, I don't know, chat to her tutor, you know, through, I don't know, Slack or something. And that experience needs to be kind of holistic for those students. And obviously in your role, you're looking at student experience and supporting them. I wonder if you've seen already a shift in demand, a shift in expectation, if you like, in that student body into a more integrated world or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the issues that all universities are dealing with is the fact that students are, you know, there are a lot of them, certainly the ones that you know your traditional sort of 18-year-olds coming in, there a lot of them will be used to a really slick, seamless digital ecosystem that they're working in. You know, that as you've said, they're on all those different kinds of social media and it just works. Works properly, it integrates, you know, it does what it's supposed to. And then they come into university, and some of our systems are great,
right,
might be a little bit more clunky. And maybe don't work as well together as they should, or perhaps don't look like they were designed in 2021. And I think that can be potentially a shock to students.
Right.
I think they don't appreciate, it takes a lot longer for our systems to be updated. And we don't have the development teams, for example.
Okay.
You know,
it's not the technology teams on call kind of thing in the same way.
Not in the same way. We'll have our technology enhanced people or our learning technologists, but still, you know, we're locked into systems that we've tendered for. They're probably on a contract for 5 years or something. You know, we don't have the capacity or the ability to make those changes on the dime and make it the slick experience that they're necessarily used to.
And is that something that's starting to become a need that your organisation recognise, or is it kind of like, oh, what are we going to do to make this work for us sort of thing? So early stages.
Yeah, I mean, in some places we are able to make changes. So we've done a lot of work, for example, on our library services web pages. So they've been really designed with like really good UX principles, user experience principles in mind. You know, we've tested things with students and staff. Kind of works in a way that makes sense and you would expect. And there are other pieces of work around the university to do the same sort of work. Web pages. There are probably other bits of systems that, you know, nothing on the market really that great, but actually it's sort of an integral building block of our students to interact with. But I think it's becoming more and more to sort of the forefront of people's minds, definitely. And then of course, as you've said, you know, that what she's going to want your daughter in terms of the learning experience, you know, everyone's had to really skill up over the last year and kind of go, how do I teach online? And that's not just it's not just taking what I would have done in a physical classroom and delivering it in the same way. You've got to do it differently. Online pedagogy is slightly different. So everyone's grappling with that. And some people have taken to it. Other people are really looking forward to being back in a classroom where they don't have to think about, I've got to look at chats and this, and now I've got to share my slides and you know, all of those things. So
do you think it will ever truly revert to where it was a year ago?
No.
In terms of teaching style?
No.
What do you think you'll keep and what do you think you'll drop from the last year?
I think generally there's going to be a lot more blended learning. So things like massive lectures, I think those are much more likely to be moved online now because you don't have to worry about finding a lecture theatre that fits all those people in. From the stuff that my team teach, some of it is much better in a classroom because you know, if you've got people working on problems and you want to be able to get round and that's better in a classroom. But there's other stuff that works much, much better online because they're much more willing to put what they think of as a stupid question into the chat than they would ever be to put a hand up in the classroom. And we've seen.
So that's the other thing which I wonder. I think kids now are so used to social media interaction and typing their questions and interacting through, you know, words, basically written words in a chat situation, that putting the hand up in class is actually not a natural skill for them anymore. Asking a question is kind of mentally miles more intimidating than putting a comment on something or liking something. And so my daughter was on online school for 6 hours a day for months, and you could sense the increasing detachment, if you like. And I say sporadic engagement. And it wasn't because the teachers were not interesting, because they were doing their very best to remain interesting. I just think in an online world, the interactivity has to be miles higher than in the face-to-face classroom to create the same kind of engagement. So one of the things I've been watching recently is the University of Kent have got a series of seminars and lectures on digital education. I think anyone can join. I think it's open to different people. I'm not a university person and I'm on it. And what's been really interesting, both for me watching conferences and speaking at conferences and looking at their presentations and webinars around how they're teaching their students, is actually, online presentation is absolutely key. Awareness of how you look on screen, how your users are interacting with you, whether everyone's suddenly dropped off and fallen asleep or whatever. That's a really difficult thing to measure when you're speaking to, effectively a bunch of screens that the video might be on or off, you're not really sure.
Most likely off.
Yeah, exactly. And if your screens are off and it's muted, are those people actually doing something completely different? They're just on, you know. So one of the things I've been thinking about and talking about is how do you measure that engagement from your audience? How do you keep people interacting with you and keep their eyes open, really, listening, without being able to physically see them?
Yeah.
So, you know, in a lecture theatre in a university, if you're at the back, you know, you can sort of a little, but it's going to be pretty obvious. And so the future of digital education, in my mind, is not just about the quality of presentations and lectures. It's about kind of this ongoing rating engagement conversation with the students who are sitting on screen. And also, it's quite tiring watching lectures on screen.
Mm.
So one of the people I did talk to, they've actually reduced their lecture for an hour to 40 minutes because they said the engagement just drops off.
Yeah.
You can kind of visibly see
yeah.
that it's just not there for them anymore.
Yeah. I think there is research out there about, you know, the optimum length of time yeah. that you should be kind of delivering, transmitting yes, information. Yeah. And I think it's, you know, an absolute maximum of 20 minutes before you've got to stop and kind of go, all right, now put something into the chat or, yes. you know, a breakout room or,
yes.
you know, put a reaction on the screen or yeah. whatever it is, but something that kind of checks that they're there and they're engaging. And then you can yeah. kind of go back to, well, here's a bit more information. And then we do an engagement.
Yes, meeting. Yes. And it's also one of the things they mentioned was that some of the lecturers have found breaking an hour lecture into modules of 10 minutes, 10 minutes on each topic for that lecture. So I don't know whatever the subject was, but you kind of have the overarching subject of the lecture, and then you break it down into categories of what you're going to talk about. And actually that 10 minutes means that people remain more engaged, but it also means that some people can binge watch after. And some people might slice and dice, so they literally watch the 10 minutes, do the test, do the feedback, then watch the next 10 minutes. And what they've seen is that student interaction with their resources is very different person to person.
Mm.
So, and it often depends on the time available for that person, whether they're watching live, whether they're watching a recording.
Yeah.
It's something I've been very conscious of in my YouTube videos or my podcasts. I think committing an entire hour to listening to a podcast is a really long time. And it's not so much that it's not interesting. It's just that in my day, 15 minutes is about my optimum listening time in terms of between other things that I've got to do type stuff. So
yeah,
if I see a video of 15 minutes, I think, right, great, I can just about watch that. Or 5 minutes, even better. But an hour, I've actually got a video that I've planned to watch for over 3 months. And it's still in my inbox, and it's a really interesting subject with a really interesting person, but I just haven't been able to kind of secure the headspace to listen to it in its entirety. And I know that if I only listen to half of it, then I don't get the benefit, you know, benefit yeah. of the investment you're making. So anyway, we've gone completely off the track of imposter syndrome, which doesn't really matter because I can always split the interview up into multiple parts, but was there anything else you wanted to mention that I should include, you know, feelings now you know, parting comments, as it were?
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered everything probably, haven't we?
Fabulous. So I'm conscious that we went quite off piste.
Well, if it gets you content for two podcasts, you know, so
yay!
Be it.
Well, no, it's been really interesting to talk to you. You're my first female interviewee, so on that basis, you know, you're unique so far. So thank you very much for your time, Sarah.
Absolute pleasure. It's been lovely having a chat.
Great.